grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight our speaker is Marianne Epp from Huntington Beach.
Hi everybody, I'm Marianne, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Mike for asking me to come down and share tonight, and thank my husband for doing the driving. He's not in the program, and so for him to spend a Friday night at an AA meeting is not on his list of favorite things to do. But thank you for coming down with me. I've been taught to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. But then there's like certain things I want to tell you, and it's like, well, should I do first? Should I, you know? And then I'll forget to tell you anything. I better just do it and start in a general way what it used to be like. But I also want to tell you that I've heard people sharing now, and they say what it was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. And then I'm thinking, well, you know, what is it supposed to be, what I'm trying to be like, which I'm not yet, or, you know, what I am, what I think I am, and it gets to be way too complicated. So, well, I mean, I will just stay with, I stumble around a lot because my drinking days were incredibly boring, and they were all, I was trying so hard to hide everything that I was doing because, you know, I didn't want anybody to know, you know, what was happening. And then I come into AA, and everybody wants to know. It's like, well, when was your first drink, and what did you do, and how many cars did you wreck? And I'm like, oh, my God, if I would have known that I'm supposed to share this, you know, maybe I wouldn't have tried so hard to hide what I was doing. So it takes me a little bit to have to admit that, because I always wanted, you know, when I came into AA and I found out there were party girls, you know, and there was the bad boys, and I'm like, wow, you know, I missed out on all that stuff. But I was raised in Missouri and in St. Louis, and it was very kind of close-knit. I mean, I don't know what your impression of St. Louis is, but I mean, it's not exactly a hick town by any means, but we lived in a very, very kind of isolated, close community. And my mother is one of six children. She's the only one that got married. All the rest are nuns and priests. And so you can't imagine what the childhood was like, because there was a lot of convents and monasteries and church every day. We went to the Catholic church, the whole thing. And I tell you, from the get-go, I was not happy about that. So it made it very, very difficult for me when I eventually came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I see words like, you know, higher power, God of our understanding. And I, you know, that was one of my first rebellions. It's like, if you would have had to go through what I went through, you know, you wouldn't be buying this stuff either. But you stay around here for a while, and it changes. So I used to say there was no other alcoholics in my family. I'm one of four, and as far as I knew, of course they're all nuns and priests, they were not drinking, but my parents were not alcoholic, but there was four of us, and I am sober. I have two normal sisters. I mean, they're the kind of sisters who did well in school, did what they were told, they went to college, they graduated from college in the four-year period, and they went to work for a company and stayed there until they retired. And then I had a brother who was like me, and he died of this disease. I'm thinking it was nearly 10 years ago now, and they found him in his house. He'd been dead for a couple of days, and he had just, you know, isolated and lived in a little trailer in Clarksville. And I don't know how those things happened, that he saw me get sober, and his thing was to stay away. And I just feel so incredibly lucky that I have been able to stay. So we're in this little community, and I just wasn't happy about anything. When, you know, the book says that it has those words, we're restless, irritable, and discontent, and I always was. And I just didn't like anything. I didn't like We lived in an old house. I thought it should be new. We went to an all-girls Catholic school. I didn't think we should be doing that. If my parents took us on vacation, that's not where I wanted to go. And my mother dressed us, and I didn't like the way she dressed us. And I just wasn't really happy about anything. And my goal, if anybody would have said, you know, what do you want? It was like, I want to be free, and I don't want anybody telling me what to do. So I got married at 19, and so that was not a good move on my part. And I married a man who, in a general way, was not a nice man. And he didn't treat me the way my dad treated my mother. And a bunch of stuff started happening all at one time. I don't know how to make it all quite fit, but the marriage was really not going well. And I was starting to have, I guess you call it anxiety. So my sobriety date is August 31st, 1981. And so I like to say some in those days. But one of the things in those days is they didn't put labels on anything. So today, you know, we have bipolar and we're depressed and we're schizophrenic and we're this. But in those days, I was going to this doctor because, you know, I didn't know what was wrong. I think maybe today they would have called it a panic attack. But I was having these episodes where I just, like, would freeze, you know, and I'd be, like, outside of a building and I couldn't go in. And I would just stand out there. And so I started going to a psychiatrist. The marriage isn't going well. We thought that we would have children, and I couldn't get pregnant. And so all of this is happening at one time. So we decide that we're going to adopt. And so right around all of this time, I started going to the psychiatrist, and he said if I went faithfully, I think, you know, once or twice a week to him, you know, that he thought that, you know, that he could, like, fix me, make me better. I don't know. But in the midst of all of this, I went to a shower and somebody gave me a martini. Now, I've had sissy drinks in the past, but I had never felt the effect of alcohol. And at this women's shower, it was the first thing I'd had in my, you know, I hadn't eaten that day. And it just, I mean, it worked wonders. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that, but I can remember the feeling. And I can remember that it just seemed like, I don't know, say I was able to breathe, you know, that I was able to breathe probably was the big thing. And I remember at some point it was like, you know, I don't need the psychiatrist. You know, this drink did for me in like 10 minutes what the psychiatrist said was going to take 2 years. And so I was immediately drawn, you know, that I had my solution. And it worked for me I don't know all the dates anymore. I mean, when you don't think you're ever going to tell anybody what you're doing, you don't remember the date of your first drink, the date of this, you know, whatever. But I do know that it was in the midst of all of this stuff that I had that drink. And I can remember that that I had that feeling that that was my solution. And I immediately began to drink every day. I just really needed it. I mean, very quickly it became apparent to me that if I needed to go into a store, man, you get that bottle. So I also was not one. I think I called myself a martini drinker for a while. But, you know, the point was I never drank it like a drink. I mean, I drank it because I needed, you know, to get into a store. I needed to go here. I needed to go there. And I learned very quickly that a couple drinks in me and I could do it, you know, go wherever I wanted. And so very quickly, you know, there was, you know, I just, there was no glass, there was no vermouth, there was no olive. I mean, I just drank right out of the bottle. It's like, you know, let's get it in and let's get it going. And so I drank that way. There was no martini. It was just an illusion that I had about myself. And so I started to, you know, I started to drink, you know, as much as I could and just to try to get by. And things still didn't go very well. I mean, we got my son, and it was like that didn't fix it. I mean, I think now of the things that I thought would fix it, that was one of the things, and it didn't work out. You know, wasn't really solving any problems in our marriage, so we decided to get another one. And so so then we got my daughter. Now I have two of them. And, you know, and I'm just miserable. I'm not happy. I'm trying to, like, do this housewife thing, and unfortunately, I mean, you guys all look like you're very cool, so I'm sure you don't have to deal with this, but I was like this little housewife, and I was trying to do what I thought housewives should do. And so that meant, you know, you stay home and you cook, although I don't think I really cooked, and you're supposed to clean house, and maybe I did a little, and you're supposed to raise the kids. And I really, you know, it's almost like, now I like to say, it's almost like bringing home a kitten or a puppy, and they're so cute. But then, you know, then you have to take care of them, you know, and that was getting to be a problem for me, that that wasn't what I thought it was going to be either. So now I've got these two kids, you know, my husband is starting to talk to me about my drinking, and, you know, and I thought I was so cool and so clever, and he was gone a lot. And at some point, because I didn't know what it was like. I didn't know what it was like until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, because of, you know, being around people who were drinking, and I realized what I smelled like. Now I'm getting really, you know, not sticking to my deal, but I didn't know until I got into AA, you know, like what I smelled like, what I acted like. And so my husband would, you know, say to me, look at you, you know, you're drunk, you can't, you're slurring your words, you know, you're slurring, you can't walk straight. And I could look at him and say, I don't know what's the matter with you. You know, I'm not drinking. I don't know why you say those things to me. And I think if there was a lie detector on me, I probably meant it. It was like, what is the matter with him? And all that happened was then I had to try harder, you know, to hide my drinking, because, you know, stopping just wasn't an option in those days. And so I had to hide it more. And it just causes bizarre behavior. I think the book talks about, you know, our alcoholic life became the only normal one. And so for me, you know, the normal one was, you know, trying to make sure you had alcohol 24 hours a day. And in those days, stores were closed on Sundays, so you had to make sure you had enough to cover Sundays. If there was a voting day, they closed the bars and the liquor stores on voting day. And so you always had to make sure that, you know, you had this alcohol, you know, within reach. And then at one time, my husband took me on a trip. I mean, we didn't have many good times, but he did one time take me on a trip. And I got on the plane, and I just panicked because I was on this plane, and there was no alcohol available to me. And as soon as we got off, I managed to buy a bottle and keep it in my suitcase. And I wasn't smart enough to buy, like, little bottles. I bought, like, say, maybe a fifth. But then it only came in my suitcase. So anytime I needed a drink, I carried my suitcase with me into the bathroom, into the wherever I needed, because that's where the booze was. So I wasn't very sophisticated then, but I got better, and I just learned to carry bigger purses carry very big purses. And I had it all over the house. It was in my car. It was, you know, in the bedroom, in the bathroom. I mean, you name it, there was a bottle there. I had a neighbor who we were very close to one another. And as part of my little housewife thing, I tried to sew. And she came over to my house one day, and she found a fifth of vodka in my sewing machine and never said a word. Not until I got sober. She said, I wondered why you had that bottle of vodka in your sewing machine. So as you can tell, there was booze all over. And I was, at some point, when I switched to vodka, I was having some trouble with my stomach, and I had gone to the doctor and, you know, was complaining, and it was probably a typical conversation where he said, you know, are you drinking, or, you know, do you drink? And it was like, well, I have my drink or two every day. And I said, I am a martini drinker. And he said, well, you know, that the gin can be very hard on your stomach, so I would suggest, you know, vodka. So that's when I became the vodka drinker. And I truly believe that it was clear. I mean, it was clear. It couldn't possibly, you know, nobody would smell that. And I truly believe that. So I was going to like room mother meetings. I was working in the school library. I was trying to do all of these things, but unfortunately I just hated it. And that's the way I smelled, I'm sure. And nobody ever said anything to me about it, except my husband, that damn husband. And he would call me, and I'd be at home and he'd be at work, and he'd call and he'd say, you know, when I come home tonight, we're going to talk about your drinking. And I'd think, well, let's give him something to talk about. So, you know, that was the day. we're going to give him something to talk about. So, but he was really getting, He was really getting on my nerves, actually. And he was not a drinker. I mean, he would have like a drink or two and he would get sick. And so he was not a drinker. And he just started watching me. But it just became harder and harder to try to hide what I was drinking because I needed more and more. And then after a while that didn't do it. And there was just a couple, when people said, when I got in here, they said, you know, did you take any pills? I'm like, oh, no, you know, I just drank alcohol. Because since they were prescribed, you know, I didn't think that counted. But, you know, you get a little bit of a clear head, and I realized that, oh, yes, there was the antidepressants, and, oh, yeah, there was the whatever caused, like anxiety, that whatever you take, some of the names I've forgotten already. And so we were mixing it, you know, with those and then trying to hide it from my husband. And then I was a den mother. And I, every Monday, I can remember, I hauled, you know, a carload of Cub Scouts to the meeting. And I was drunk. And the first thing that I remember being thankful for in AA was that I didn't wipe out any of those kids. I mean, I never thought, you know, I never thought that, gee, this could be a problem. I just thought, oh, my God, we're going to a meeting. And I, you know, I don't want to face these kids for that hour and a half, whatever it was. And I just didn't want to face anything. And so more and more, it took more and more so that I could live that life that I didn't think I really wanted to live anyway. And I was having some health problems, and it was getting harder and harder to keep the alcohol because of the way I was living. When I came into AA and found out I could have gone to a bar and everybody there would have been drinking, and I thought, you know, why didn't I know that? But I didn't know that. And so the way I was living is like nobody's doing what I'm doing, and so, you know, you just have to hide it. And so I, after a while, as I needed more and more alcohol, you don't want anybody to know exactly what you're doing. So it was like one day you could go to the liquor store and get your liquor. Maybe the next day you would go to a drugstore and get your liquor. And then maybe the next day you'd go to the grocery store. And I remember truly thinking I could go to the grocery store and buy a half gallon of vodka, some tomatoes, and think that, you know, they would think that that was my grocery shopping. And I really thought that that made a lot of sense. And so it was, you know, again, it was getting harder and harder to try to keep, you know, all the alcohol in the house. Then my next solution was, it was really the husband. You know, if that man, you know, if I did not have to live with that man, I wouldn't have to drink. And so we got divorced, and I think it was probably in under maybe 3 or 4 months, and I was in the hospital because he was the last person that really knew what was going on in that house. And in some sort of a weird way, you know, he was, you know, he could check on me, I guess. And once he was gone, you know, it just didn't make any difference. And one of my other solutions, he told me I was a bored housewife and I needed to get a job. And so in the midst of all this, I did get a job, and I only had to work 3 days a week, and they didn't tell me which 3 days it had to be. And so I never had to say, oh, I'm too sick to come into work today. You know, if it was a day, then I really couldn't hack it. I just didn't come in. And so, you know, that kind of allowed me to hide what I was doing. Although, you know, eventually I had a bottle in my drawer at work, and I spent a lot of time in bathrooms. It was like, I just, when I needed a drink, I mean, where are you going to go? So it was in the bathroom or wherever. And in the early days, I guess, of when I would have so much trouble, you know, I couldn't go in a building. I just couldn't go. But then by that time, you know, I was discovering that if I had a few drinks, you know, that I could go into the building, I could shop, I could do whatever I wanted, except that eventually that would start to wear off. And then if you're in a store, then you have to find a dressing room. And now when I see all the surveillance, I thought, oh, my God, was there surveillance back there watching, you know, sitting on the little bench, you know, just pulling the vodka out and drinking. And I don't know if there was or not, but I know there sure is today. And so anyway, my next solution then was to divorce him. And after that, you know, it really didn't make any difference. I couldn't tell you a lot about what happened. I don't know how my kids were, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't really tell you that much about what was going on with them. I just wanted to drink. Now, my son has told me, you know, in sobriety, he said, Mom, you just used to always just sit in your bedroom. You never came out of your room. So I guess, you know, that's what I was doing, was sitting in there. And I don't know, you know, how they were doing, but, you know, they managed to survive okay. And I eventually ended up in a hospital because I was one of those that, I don't want to eat because, that could ruin a good drunk. So I wasn't eating much, and I wasn't drinking much water, and so I ended up in the hospital, and from the hospital they told me, I don't know how to describe it. In the hospital they said, when you leave here, we're going to put you in a detox. In 1981 in Missouri, the detox, they were in like a heyday. I mean, everybody was going, to the treatment center, and I'll have to tell you, I got into a really nice one, and I thought that when I went in there, my life was over. I just, I was so humiliated, and it took me, in the hospital even, they gave me some medication to help ease everything that was going on. But man, once I got into the detox, the rehab, they took everything. And I was so naive about alcoholism and an alcoholic that I tried to sneak a bottle in my luggage when I went in there and was shocked that they went through my luggage. I mean, I was so naive, and so that was the end of my bottle. And after a few days, and my head started to clear, I was getting some stuff from the treatment center. I mean, but then it went to the other way. I'm like, I have the answers now. They're telling me, you don't drink. It's the first drink that gets you drunk. And we have, when you leave here, you go to AA. And then we had charts, and we had medical knowledge, and we had this thing that showed the descent into alcoholism, and then, what your recovery is like. And, and we had all of this stuff. We had group therapy, and I thought I had the answer. When I left that treatment center, I thought, I'm fine. I mean, thank you for all that information. I'll be okay now. And so they had taken us to a few AA meetings, and I couldn't tell you what I thought about them. I went and I didn't feel at home. I was actually, when I got sober, I was sick. I mean, there had been so long since I had to face life with nothing in my system that I was like physically sick, and walking into a room full of people was just more than I could bear. And I think there, I don't know if you want to call it a miracle, God's grace, whatever, but I was able to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think that, this was the answer for me. I didn't know that, there was nothing really calling me except people were laughing, and I was not coming from a laughing family. We were a German family, and if there's a stereotype of German, we were it. I mean, you did it this way, you don't ask questions, and I still have a little bit of that in me today. It's like, okay, I'm going to speak for 40 minutes. I should spend 10 minutes here, and then we'll do 10 minutes here, and then maybe I can have 10 minutes over there. So I still have a lot of that stuff in me. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really, I wasn't sure that I felt like I was home. I didn't think that I didn't even know if I wanted to stay sober. Actually, I had no goals, like I'll stay here for a while, maybe I'll stop drinking, or maybe I'll do this. I just sort of took it like from one meeting to a time, one meeting at a time, one meeting to a time. The steps made absolutely no sense to me. The steps, as I seem to recall when I got here, is like, look, you're telling me that I'm not supposed to drink anymore, and you're offering me steps. I mean, you're offering me steps. I mean, I wanted like a pill of some kind or maybe some therapy, but the steps made no sense. And they were saying that I was powerless over alcohol. And I'm thinking, how can I be powerless over alcohol when that is the one thing that makes me comfortable? That is the one thing. And now you're saying, I'm powerless over it. And the thought of, living my life without it, just didn't seem possible. But, we did, I don't have the women I sponsor write step one, but in those days we wrote it, and they had me write out, things that I did while I was drunk. And that's when I began to realize that I was driving, with all of these kids in the car, and my own children as well. And that, I had a thing for some power tools, and I used to, I had a buffet, whatever, I can't tell you, but I remember I took it one day and I took this whatever tool you use, and I sliced off the feet of it, and I made it into something else. And so But I never did anything without drinking. If I was going to be sewing, and I had to be pretty drunk to do the sewing. So I just couldn't figure out how this was going to work for me. And this powerlessness was, very hard for me to digest. And then they're talking about higher power. And I'm like, I was Catholic. We did this. It didn't work for me. And what changed my mind about that was watching the people around me. And I had a sponsor who would say to me, can you at least believe that I can believe? And I said, yeah. And I remember they had me say, read To the Agnostic in the big book. And I read To the Agnostic, and it meant nothing. It's like, I don't know what that all means. In fact, I think I was telling people I was an atheist. I was like, really ridiculous. And so the idea that there was going to be this higher power or this God in my life did not really set very well with me. But I could believe that she believed, and she was happy. She was, she was outgoing and friendly, had sobriety. And I guess because she believed, that was like my start. And I think about, it says, came to believe. And so I think about it as came. I came to AA. I literally came to in AA, and I came to believe, and that's exactly the way it came for me. And then step three was this transition from thinking about, that God is going to get me. I know he will, because, I did this and I did this, and then at some point you think, well, shit, he doesn't care, and I've screwed up so bad that, is there, any way I can get back in anybody's good graces? And then because it said the care of God, that was what kind of got me over that hump, that I changed the way I was raised and, the punishment that I would get to a God that cares about you. And that was a big transition for me as well. So many of these steps were just my transition. When I did four, my fourth step, it was this transition from when I got in here. I had my litany of things, everything that they did to me. It was what my parents did to me, what that husband did to me, those kids weren't behaving right. I had this whole list of grievances. And doing the four, and when I got sober, they didn't say, how do they say out here? They say, where's your fourth column? Where's your fourth column? They just said, what's your part in it? And so when I did the fifth step with my sponsor, it was like, well, what is your part in it? And it really made that transition from everything that they did to me to look at myself and see, what I had done, what I had, how I behaved. And that was the one thing that allowed me to make amends to my first husband, because I had the list. It was like I could tell you the things that he did to me. And at some point when I was sober, I realized, what I was, and what I was the woman he was describing to me. I couldn't walk straight. If I would sit down, I couldn't get up. It was, slurring your words and smelling bad. And so it allowed me to think about, it took me a long time to make amends to him. I'm kind of jumping around here, but I did want to tell you, the four was that big transition from everything that was done to me to looking at myself and, the actions that I had taken. And the fifth step was, I think, the first time I trusted somebody. I trusted this woman enough that I could take this stuff to her, and I didn't think she would laugh at me or criticize me or anything. And I remember that feeling that I trusted her, and that was a very unique feeling for me. Six and seven was just like, adding new words to my vocabulary, because when I got here, I could have told you I was mad. That was about the only thing that I, that actually came to my, to my mouth when you asked me. But these other words that they were throwing at me, anger and resentment and, those are the biggies, because those are still my biggie ones today. And I really didn't know about any of those things. And it took me a while to learn how they were in my life and how they were not actually an asset to my life, because I thought, these are the things that helped to get me by. And I have come, in fact, I say that seven-step prayer every day, because it reminds me that my goal is to try to be useful. And it says that in the seven-step prayer. And I began to learn about some of those things that held me back from living the kind of life that I wanted to live. Because by that time, now I'm starting to, over the years, see that there is a life out there for me. And it was something, that I wanted to strive for. And so then, we come to eight and nine, and, geez, I had a reason for everybody. My kids, My kids were on the list, and they were easy because I felt so guilty that even after I made the amends to them, I thought, I don't think that I will ever be able to make up for them for the years that they had to live with me. And but then my parents could not even bring themselves to say Alcoholics Anonymous. They would say, those meetings, where you go. And I said to my sponsor, I don't know how I can make amends when they don't even want to say Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, you make amends to them and you tell them the kind of, you tell them the things that you're sorry for and that you're not going to, that you don't want to live that way anymore. And you do not have to mention the words Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what I did with that one. Then I had the ex-husband. And I came in here and it was like, I will never forgive him for the things he did to me. Well, you hang around here for a while and people are talking about their amends. And it like was enough to pique my interest, like, well, and then it was like, well, how do you do that? And then somebody said, well, why don't you just pray for willingness? So then I spent some time, praying for willingness. And then my last question was, well, do I have to mean it? And so they said, no, you don't have to mean it. You just have to do it. But I will tell you, by the time I made amends to him, I did mean it, because by that time I knew the kind of, the kind of wife that I had been. And So then, 10 was, help. 10, I think, gave me this little, I call it my little indoor radar here that, good, bad, whatever, if I want to do something, you just do it. And after a while, and there's nothing in here, I got this little thing here in my belly now that, if you do something, that's hurtful or whatever, my stomach tells me. And so when I make an amends at night, it's not an in-depth, an in-depth thing. It was like, I know what kind of a day I've had. And so either amends need to be made or, I can go to sleep peacefully. And then 11 did finally teach me how to pray, because I was very specific when I got here. I want the husband that does this. I want the kids to be smart. I want them to listen to me. I want to have lunch with my mother. I thought once I did amends with my mother, we'd be having lunch together and, doing this. And that never happened. And so, but it taught me how to pray. Pray only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry out. And then 12 is I guess kept me going. My spiritual awakening was very kind of like it describes in the back of the book, where it says, this gradual change in feeling and outlook. And that's probably about as much as I got, because when I got here, I wanted to die. I mean, I was never actively trying to commit suicide. It was more like, I just want to die. And if I just lay here, maybe death will descend upon me. But as you can see, it didn't. But I mean, that was, I just wanted to die. And today, I don't want to die anymore. And and I have stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous for 32 years. I think, I don't know if I mentioned that, my sobriety day is August 31st of 1981. And I have stayed consistently, and I have always done meetings, and I have tried, at times I've been more active than others, but I have always stayed. And it has given me a life that I really never, I would have never even been able to tell you what I wanted. I just wanted to get by, I just wanted to, just a little piece of some kind. And I don't, I want to tell you this because one of the most drastic changes, one of the biggest changes in my life is that I have gone from this woman who couldn't even go to a store and would just sit outside and hover, to marrying this man over here, and he's a traveler. And since I have married him, we have been all over. And every time we go on a plane, I think we're going to be killed. And then we've gone to these countries where it's like, I know we're going to be killed. They're gonna haul us off, and nobody's going to know where we are. And of course, it's never happened. But I think AA also taught me, to face my fears. And if I'm afraid, my sponsor has a mantra that she has me do, and breathing and stuff. And I just go ahead and do it. But the thought that I had those times where I just could not even go inside of a building, to, taking trips to some of the places that we've taken. And I think that, it's like, how do you get from there to there? And I did it, with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and like nothing else. I mean, I've had no other therapy. There's no pills. There's no nothing else. It's like, go to my meetings. And I have a sponsor that that I really trust her and I trust her judgment and I use her. I don't think I have it together yet that I can start, you know, living my own life without her direction. And I have women that I sponsor, and it's like this whole little chain. It's like she is a sponsor, and then I have her, and then I have women that I sponsor, and they now have women that they sponsor, and there's this whole chain. And I just love that the way that that works, and I love the way Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in my life, and it has given me a life I never thought I could ever have. So I'm glad that you guys were here to listen tonight. Thank you for listening.